These worlds, when they're built, will be so compelling, in my view, that it's going to drive a growth spurt in gaming that, like the likes of which we haven't seen since 2D became 3D, or we saw the internet, or we saw mobile. Those all going to double, triple the industry in a short period of time. This is going to do that again, because this is what we've been dreaming about since we watched our first Star Trek episode and imagined the holodeck. We've been wanting this for a very long time. We're going to get it.
How will generative AI change gaming? No surprise to anybody, generative AI is the hottest thing in tech right now, and that might even be especially the case in gaming. Well, guess what? Games are hard. They're incredibly challenging to create. There's images, video, sounds, objects, characters, dialogue, and code itself, all of which can be built faster, cheaper, if not always better, by AI. Roblox is doing generative AI. Meta is doing generative AI for the metaverse, if that's not canceled yet. Microsoft is testing generative AI for Minecraft. What is Unity going to do? To find out, we're chatting with Unity CEO John Riccitiello. He's an OG in gaming, former CEO of Electronic Arts, long history in business, companies like Haagen-Dazs and Pepsi. And I think this is the third time we're chatting. Welcome, John.
Well, it's great to be here. And good morning, John.
Good morning. Excellent. Love the art behind you. Love the topic as well, generative AI. Let's start with the big picture. What is Unity doing in generative AI?
It's hard to say what we're not doing, actually.
Good.
Let me focus it for you. So, people think of Unity as doing two things in our business. One is helping creators create games or digital twins. So we're a content creation platform. And the second is we're a platform for helping people operate and monetize their games and, you know, other applications. And, you know, we're the leader in both spaces. So, you know, we're the benchmark, if you will. Now, well over half, you know, in mobile, over 70% of games are built in Unity. We're very proud of that. We've been doing AI in that space for several years now. And so there are lots of tools inside of Unity that enable people to leverage the best of what AI can offer to advance or accelerate or to improve upon the output that they're trying to get to, the content they're trying to build. And that lives, you know, within our Weta tool chain, where, you know, most of those tools wouldn't be possible without components of AI. And it lives within Unity. It lives within, you know, the tools we use for facial animation and all sorts of things. And I'll talk to you about where that goes, but we've been at that for a long time. It also lives within our operate, you know, side of the business. We've been using neural networks for 3 years to help developers find users, do it more cost efficiently, to deepen the engagement of their audience. And again, so for us, this is not a new subject. It's one, it's been, you know, started before OpenAI started, before ChatGPT was, you know, sort of on the forefront of everyone's, you know, conversation and thought process. And we're doing a lot more. And what I think might be interesting to talk about is where that goes for content creators, you know, the winners and losers and such. But also, I'm going to talk to you, one of the first people I'm going to talk to, about how some of what we're doing will change the very nature of what a game is and make it a lot more compelling. And I would argue in many ways, something that feels so alive that, you know, maybe we prove out the thesis that we're living in a simulation because we create one, but it's every bit as believable as the world we live in today.
So there's a lot to unpack in what you just said there, because what I think you're saying is that, hey, not only have we been using AI for a long time, we're going to be using AI a lot and generative AI to help people make games in a lot of different ways, but also we're putting that into the gaming experience so that it's real time. There's real time generative AI happening for maybe dialogue, maybe settings, environments, maybe objects. Hear that correctly?
Yes. Yeah, so let's tackle the first part, the creation side, maybe, and then we'll come on to the worlds that you can build. So I'm sure you and many of your viewers have, you know, used tools like ChatGPT or some of the generative art, the Hugging Face type of things to, you know, I want to see a girl on a bike in the style of Van Gogh or whatever. And, but when you're using it, for example, to help you write something, what are you doing? You put in a prompt and you get something back. And then ultimately you take that something you got back and you move it into a Word doc or a Google doc or something, and then you edit it and make it your own. So defining a couple terms, you're using a natural language, large language model when you're doing the first step. You're using a deterministic tool to make it precise, to make it what you want it to be. And you're iterating back and forth. Mm-hmm. Now, I think that's going to be true for animators, character artists, level designers, lighting people, physics people. They're going to be a lot more productive because they're going to continue to use deterministic tools because they need to. You can't publish the, you know, the outgrowth of an AI tool. I'm going to dig into that a little bit more in a minute. But they can be 2 times or 3 times or 10 times more productive using the combination. And that's how I see this going for most creation. And it's how the tools are used today. Now, the difference between, say, a Unity and Word or a Google Doc is pretty profound, though. And so a large language model, you know, whether it's studying, you know, photos or paintings or books or articles, whatever, to crunch, you know, dialogue or scripts, on what it's studying, the model itself sees everything if it just has the frame. So if it sees the script, it knows all the words. If it sees the painting, it knows all the pixels. Even if it looks at a movie, and right now we're not at a point where we're creating efficiently with any of these models, you know, film, if it sees the 20 frames a second that is on, you know, television or film, it's got all of the data. Games are profoundly different than that. You use, I don't know, we're playing Call of Duty, you know, you hit X, hit me in the shoulder, I duck. Think about what's going on there. And I get hit in the shoulder, my ragdoll physics, I fall to the floor. There's your input. There's my input. There's all that content that is in fact in the frames, in this case, 60 frames a second. Then underneath that, there's the instructions for lighting. There's the instructions for all those interactions. And for a model to study that, all it really sees is the frames. But there's a boatload of information that made those frames possible. So my sense is, well, while these models will eventually produce simple games, you know, the Flappy Birds of the world, I think the rich and complex things are going to be very hard for these models to produce for a bunch of reasons. One is they can't study all the data. The second thing, but I'm going to tell you why we can, but they can't study all the data. And they also kind of skip the point that you got 100 people or 20 people or 10 people working on a product together, and it's a wildly iterative process. Mm-hmm. Trying to get from, it looks like this, now how to make it fun, how to make it more engaging. And that iterative process for creation that's existed since, you know, literally, you know, the beginning of art, you know, people would sketch what they're going to paint and then sketch it 15 more times. That iterative process, the very process of creation, especially in teams, is always, you know, hugely iterative. Those things, you can't just simply, I'll give you a prompt, I'm going to get a product back. So Unity is by far the largest and most used editor in the world for creating games. And we've already got a bunch of AI tools in our product. And we're going to be introducing more and more natural language interfaces so you can talk to it and get that juicy, lovely relationship between I get a first draft from something that's non-deterministic, then I edit it to make it better. So to give you an example, I might want to tell it to give me a character that looks like X or an environment that's got trees, and that'd be great. But then I'm imagining a war over those trees or using that character. I want to move the river over a little bit. Okay, mm-hmm. So now, you know, so you might get a first draft and you're over here on editing, and then you get a first, you know, you edit this, you go back and forth. But now let's assume that I want fog. All right, now everything uses fog, right? It's like it's part of the melodrama of entertainment, is the all those beautiful foggy intersections with life, and you know, it helps people build a better story. I wouldn't even know how to describe fog, to be honest with you. But within Unity, the deterministic tools are a bunch of sliders. It gets thicker and thinner, more reflective, non-reflective. It takes a second. Do I want to talk to a natural language thing for like a week to figure out how to describe it, or just make it in a second. And the workflow I imagine that is going to, you know, replace the one that most people use today is that, you know, that brilliant accelerant, the power that a creator can have, where natural language gets them, you know, half the way there. Then they do something over here to make it a little bit better. And then they go back over here to close the gap. And then they've got it. They've got a build of their game. And then it isn't fun. And so what do they go back and the team edits it and makes changes? And that iterative process is one that I don't think goes away. I just think that creators are going to be 2 to 10 times more productive than they've ever been before, which will open all sorts of frontiers for cool new stuff.
There's some really good news in what you're saying and in how you're framing it, because there's a lot of concern that AI will cost jobs, and in some cases it will, and hopefully open up many other jobs as well. But you have Dropbox CEO saying that we're in the age of AI. That's one of the reasons why we let go of 500 people, right? But what's interesting about what you're saying is that it gives you superpowers. And what comes to my mind, I believe it was Red Dead Redemption, or maybe it was No Man's Sky, one of the two. It was a game that was massive in scale and scope for the world and the universe. And it took 8 years for hundreds of artists. They had literally 100 musicians scoring all the music that was used in it. And it took 8 years to get this game off the floor. And how much does the world change? How much does technology change? How much do our tastes change in 8 years? And how much investment do you have if you're building this AAA game for 8 years and you don't even know if you're going to get some ROI on it? And so what I'm hearing and what you're saying is, A, there's a lot of tools that is going to speed up. I need some music. I need a character. I need an object. Other things like that that you can work with. That's interesting. That's good, because then it's an interplay between a person, a creator, an intelligent artist, designer, developer, and the machine. So that's cool. The other thing that's interesting is that a lot of generative AI that is visual is 2D. There's not a ton that's 3D, and as you said, not any perhaps, that understands the interplay, the rules of the universe in a particular game, the rules of what can happen or not happen, why things are happening, what's going on. It's interesting to imagine a generative AI built within the Unity environment, understanding the physics and other things and the fog and other things like that, and the capabilities that you could have in that world.
Well, you make some really interesting points. First off, I wasn't involved in the production of either, you know, Red Dead or No Man's Sky. But if I recall, you know, press at the time, I believe they're both giant worlds, but I believe they actually use very different methodologies for creating their environments. Red Dead, I believe, was actually quite a traditional process, you know, artist drawing environments. I believe No Man's Sky was out, most of the environments were algorithmically created. And I remember at the time, there was some really beautiful things that were algorithmically created, but there was also some comment about how it felt a little lifeless. And in a weird sort of way, dead straight up, sort of lacking humanity. And now look, that's a I don't know if that's actually a legitimate way of looking at it, but I do believe they had different ways of getting it. I do remember some of the criticism. Now, within this world, I think you make the point that humans are going to be involved. 100% agree. And you know, one of the things I would tell you is I don't think in this world where you know we live at the bleeding edge of the most interesting entertainment media in the world, in the content creation end of it. I don't think anybody's job in this world, in the creation side, is going to be taken by an AI, but it will get taken by a human using AI, because those people are going to be more productive and they're going to have to be, you know, they're going to just force multiply their ability to realize what they can conceive. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, within that, you know, that added productivity, remember the most successful games are multi-billion dollar franchises. And at least what I've witnessed in the quarter of a century I've been working on building games, which is a frightening thought right there, is that given the size of the prize, The most important developers on the planet will put anything in terms of effort and spend to make their product better and more compelling. Mm-hmm. And so my expectation is these ambitious companies are going to use AI to make things even more entertaining and more engaging than it was ever possible before. But, you know, maybe that's a good pivot to what might be possible or is possible that heretofore wasn't even imaginable. Mm-hmm. Because I think that's a super interesting subject. Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about that. And I also want to get to the marketplace, so let's not forget that piece as well. But let's talk about that in-game experience. We've grown up with games, right? And the dialogue, for one thing, I'm you know, it's very stilted, sometimes inappropriate, just doesn't fit the situation. You've got the Jumanji movies, right, where they're in the game environment and they get the same guy saying the same thing every single time, doesn't get it. Imagine something like ChatGPT hooked up to characters who are NPCs that don't feel like NPCs. Talk about what you're thinking about for in-game experiences that are powered by AI.
So I'm going to describe to you something beautiful that is going to be both too expensive and virtually impossible to make work. And then I'm going to bridge it to tell you how it actually can work. So in virtually every game, not every game, but in, you know, if you play a MOBA, this isn't true because there's no non-player characters, or there are not a lot of non-player characters. But most games have lots of non-player characters in them. You interact with them. And somebody wrote every line of dialogue. Mm-hmm. They wrote every bit of animation. And it very quickly becomes repetitive. And, you know, if you're playing, you know, GTA, for example, and you pull over to rob a liquor store, the writers, in this case, it's probably Dan Houser, if you go back in addition in the title, he and his team will have imagined, you know, 10 interactions, and each one has a line of dialogue. Maybe the clerk fights you, or the clerk just gives you the money, or the clerk runs away, and they've anticipated that, and then they wrote dialogue for that. And that's fine. And if you're playing a war game and you've got all these NPCs and you're trying to get to another place in the city, but these guys are fighting you off and getting in the way, somebody wrote, you know, very simple rules around what those things are. You know, go left, go left, go right, go right, go right, go left. You know, maybe they respond, if you go right, they go left. But they've written a collection of rules. And it doesn't often take all that much effort to figure out the seams. And you realize you're in a scripted world with severe limitations pretty quickly. Now, it's still the most compelling form of entertainment in the world, but it has its limits. And so what we imagine when we look at AI today is that each one of these characters could be as smart as ChatGPT and talk to you about anything. You could walk from the pitch to the stadium in FIFA and talk to the fans. What do you think? Hey, come out on the pitch and play with me. They can not only talk, you know, a new game, but they can also act in a new way. Now, if you could imbue those NPCs with all that, you know, seeming intelligence of a large language model, both in action and in dialogue, you'd have a staggeringly interesting world to live in and play in. And, you know, one of the things that would be like the first thing a developer would need to do, they put all this intelligence in their games, is now we have these beta periods to sort of iron out the bugs. We're going to need a beta period to train all the NPCs, right? Because, you know, but just like with, you know, OpenAI and ChatGPT, really the first few million people trained it to be infinitely smarter in terms of how a human would judge it. The first million players playing that game, messing around with it for a couple of days, those NPCs would go from sort of feeling off the reservation to being entirely alive. And it would be a combination of what the company that developed the game wrote for the backstory, like who is this character? What are this character, you know, human or non, male, female, whatever gender, whatever they put in there for its ambition. So back to that GTA liquor store clerk. Is he or she a meth addict that's just trying to make enough for a whatever the expression is that they would buy at the end of the day? I'm not in that market. Are they on summer vacation from an Ivy League school? And they might have a different, you know, orientation to whether what it means to be, you know, worth living for, right? So they might behave differently. And so you could imagine almost anything happening with that range of choice, but the creator will write that for all of them. Less than the dialogue, less than the interaction, they'll write that, but they will imbue it with a learning algorithm that will train it to achieve what it needs to achieve. And maybe a game will take a month of doing this. By the way, I would love to be a beta tester when it's off the reservation, getting it on the reservation, because that would be so much fun too. These worlds, when they're built, will be so compelling, in my view, that it's going to drive a growth spurt in gaming that, like, the likes of which we haven't seen since 2D became 3D, or we saw the internet, or we saw mobile. Those all going to double, triple the industry in a short period of time. This is going to do that again, because this is what we've been dreaming about since we watched our first Star Trek episode and imagine the holodeck. We've been wanting this for a very long time. We're going to get it. Now, the problem, this is the almost insurmountable problem, but I have a surmount of that problem for you, is that right now, all of that capability is on a server someplace. Mm-hmm. So you got latency issues and you got cost. Nobody really wants to, you know, we've all read about how much money OpenAI has invested, you know, with Microsoft to run all of that. And this is where sometimes it's better to be lucky than good. But over 5 years ago, I was with one of my colleagues, Silvio Druin, and we were talking about AI then, like a lot of people talk about it now. And we decided to start a project to see if we could get an inference engine, a learning AI tool, in Unity's runtime. And the runtime ships with every game. It's what drives all of the movement and dialogue and effects. It takes the creator's content and turns it into interactive content. And we decided to start working on that over 5 years ago. We had lots of ups and downs. We ultimately built it. We call it Project Barracuda. And what that allows is the runtime that's on the device, on your iPhone or Android device or PC or console, that runtime can now have essentially an AI model inside of it to drive those things. So it can be done locally. Mm-hmm. So as those actions are driven locally, it doesn't cost anything.
Yes.
And it happens fast. And we're unique in the world of having done that. And look, I've started a lot of things, didn't turn out to be quite so prescient. So I'm not going to claim that I'm a seer of all things. Got lucky on this one. We've kept it alive when there wasn't an obvious use for it because we thought it would be useful. We didn't know exactly what for, but now as we look at our business around digital twins, where they're going to want, you know, to go from reporting the past to asking about fixing the problem as opposed to just reporting it, or we were thinking about games that can be smart and alive, like I've just described, I can't wait to play the games that the better creators make that are maybe more interesting than my friends to hang out with. I mean, apology, friends, if you happen to be listening.
The mind boggles on a lot of different levels there. First of all, having quote-unquote NPCs that are seemingly super intelligent, powered by AI, is incredible. You could meet that clerk that you were going to rob and have a conversation about the meaning of life. You could be in a foxhole with a soldier in Call of Duty and, well, this is my girlfriend and she just broke up with me and here's a letter. You could have those kind of human engagements and interactions in a game, and it could be powered there. And you know what? The nice thing is that people have supercomputers in their pockets. They've got supercomputers in their consoles so they can run that kind of power.
And that is picked up on 4 billion of those today. My runtime is already on them.
Yeah.
And so the deployment already exists. And so against that deployment, you know, what we need is, I don't know how long you've been a student of the game industry, but, you know, I remember when I was a kid in my parents' living room playing Pong. But it's always been the case that there's like a substantial innovation and then there's a lot of followers. And I remember calling Sam Houser when I was playing, I think it was GTA 3, thinking, this is the first open world game I did play. I mean, a lot of times it sort of felt open, but this was the first one. I could drive, I could fight, I could shoot, I could hold up a liquor store. I could do anything I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. Things I won't tell you in live interview format that you could do. And I remember thinking, this changes everything. And it did. And so many games have now moved on to that model of an open world because of the freedom that players feel in that environment. And, you know, that was, to me, a super important milestone in the industry. And I was so impressed by the work. I think this is 10x the potential transformation, because I don't think anybody looks at their games and thinks of them as real worlds. They're sort of scripted fantasy worlds, whether you're playing an RPG like Dragon Age or a sports game or a open world, you know, environment like a GTA, or you're playing an Endless Runner, whatever you're playing, you know, they're great. But what has happened is the creators have basically taken the long set of rules that we used to read for board games and transformed them into real-time 3D. But there's still constraints and rules. And we're about to find out what happens when we make these worlds fully alive in terms of how it feels to the player. I can't wait.
Unleashing games and unbounding games, that is super interesting. I do want to hit on the marketplace. You've talked about that. And the news that you released, I think something like a month ago or so, is you will have an AI marketplace, or a marketplace for objects that people have created with generative AI. It reminded me a little bit of people made a living on Second Life making clothing and other objects and stuff like that. People made six-figure salaries there. Talk about what you're doing with the marketplace and how that fits.
Well, first off, Unity's had an asset store for over a decade. And more people make a living in the asset store creating, you know, assets and characters and particle effects and all sorts of different things that plug into Unity already. So the marketplace exists for and virtually nobody, maybe some very large companies, but most game companies, either at prototype stage or through production, end up getting a lot of things out of the asset store, you know, from these entrepreneurs that have built, you know, really cool things. And, you know, if you're building a real-time strategy game and you've got some sort of a unit out there that might be a fortress or whatever it happens to be, depending on the fiction of the game, and you want that thing to blow up, all right? And you want to have dust clouds and flames and other stuff when it does. I mean, because it's kind of fun, like you've blown it up and you want to see it. You don't want to see it just disappear, like say somebody taking a chess piece off the table. You want to see it melt.
Broken.
And now a team of 10 can spend a month or a couple of weeks maybe drawing and animating all of those effects. They go to the asset store, they get paid $20. It's done. And so that's what they've been using the asset store now for years. And the point that we wanted to make with the asset store here, and we're working with a large number of AI, you know, startups and larger scale companies, is that Unity has the largest number of 3D real-time creators on the planet by orders of magnitude. It's a gigantic audience of creators. And we've already got a business, and always people have a business catering to that audience so they can build faster. And we're building and have built a number of AI tools. But we don't think we're the only people in the world building AI tools for 3D creation. We think there's a lot of smart people out there, lots of them. And, you know, what we want to facilitate is for a simple API connection or a quick install of an SDK, whatever, depending on the product and the service that's being offered, that just happens quickly and easily inside of the environment people are already using to build games. You know, a lot of things can take place outside of that approach too, but then they're downloading something in their PC or whatever, Mac or PC or workstation they're using to create something. They're running something over here. They're trying to figure out, you know, some sort of a workflow to get it into the product or to get the the outgrowth of that into the product. And that's a cumbersome, difficult process, but it's also really difficult for the AI startup or larger company to even get find these people, right? You got to go through this big marketing campaign to say, and we just want to make that easy, and as we've always wanted to do. And so the intention here is to expand the marketplace very deliberately around around AI tools, because, you know, I think AI tools are profoundly important, and we just want to do anything we can to help our creators be more productive.
Cool. Well, this has been super interesting. I think your outlook is calling, and many other things as well. Thank you for taking this time. Really do appreciate it.
All right. Well, thanks, John, and have a great rest of your day. And until next time.